Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Everyone.
It's another episode. Ooh.
It's our 31st birthday here on Martinis and Murder.
That's true. Did you ever hear at the end of the intro music, the little ice shaking?
Yeah.
I never quite noticed that before.
I really just focus on the breath being taken, yeah, though, so I always start off like...
I feel like there was an episode recently where I put in an alternate version of our intro that didn't have the breath in it, so I just want to say, if anyone's listening... we'll always make sure to get a breath in there for you.
Yeah, why are you experimenting with our breath?
I don't know. I don't know why that happened. You know what? It's a very technical thing, and we won't get into it. But long story short, I did what was best for the show, okay?
Don't pull a mat on us now, John. Speaking of which, yes. Guess what?
What?
I feel like today's going to be the best episode because Matt's not here.
Yay!
So finally, John and I can have some fun with this. You guys know every week we come in, we hate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really difficult for us because Matt's always nagging us and doing this, doing that. But
right.
This week, we had that one other week where we did our little concoctatini and got a little trouble in Matt's office.
Yeah.
We're back doing
in Matt's
that.
Office, yeah.
And are you ready for the martini that we're going to concoct today?
Well, I'll be honest with you. In lieu of Matt's absence, I'm going to pass on the concoctatini. I don't know what you're going to make, but I'm going to drink... tea, because my voice has just been struggling on recent episodes. I don't know if you've heard it. I've just been really struggling. So I just drank some tea. I honestly did a quick vocal warm up, which is a little
You're
bit
like,
insane.
You're like, unique New York.
I was like, humana. New York. The fox jumped over. Wait, I don't think that's the right one. But yes, something like that. And I already feel like my voice is a lot stronger. So
it feels strong. Do you want me to put a little creme de cacao in your tea? That might help.
Do you think that's...
It'll kill the germs.
You know what? We're sitting right next to... Oh, that's a good point.
It'll kill the germs. That's my belief.
We're literally sitting in Matt's office. We usually have a studio that we record in, but because Matt's out, you know, we want to take over his domain a little bit.
What if this whole Martinis and Murder was us killing your germs?
Thank you. That's
You're
a
welcome.
Good idea. But... you know, Matt has a whole cabinet here full of liquor. Do you want me just to peek and see what's
in
it?
Peek and see. The funny thing about this cabinet is that it's under lock and key, but it's never locked. So it's like, anyone can just, oh, there's the knife.
There's
okay.
A knife. I don't know if, you, let me see if I can.
Oh, that's not, you're like sharpening it against the mic. That's probably going to like.
Ooh.
Oh, that's pleasant.
Welcome to Martinis and Murder.
Yeah.
Is this legal? Can we get in trouble for this, by the way?
By showing a big butcher knife in Matt's office with a bottle of alcohol? What are you talking about?
Knives and liquor at our disposal, but the lawyers are on the phone this week. Actually, we should just mention it's lawyer now. We only have one lawyer.
It's one Laura.
And she's awesome, but hopefully she doesn't report to HR that we were sharpening knives in the liquor cabinet.
Well, I mean, if she does, we know where the source came from,
That's
and then
true.
We'll just have to get rid of her, too.
That's
just like
true.
Matt, you know what I mean? Just knock them off one by one.
There you go. Well, we do want to mention, I feel like every week, Matt's fucking something up.
Usually
something's messing up. Well, last week there was a lot of drama after the episode posted.
Was there ever, John?
Because somehow Matt sneaked into the episode. Sneaked? Snuck?
I think he snuck.
We'll get the lawyer to give us a note on that. And didn't change the audio. You could hear his actual voice. However, I've been saying that we cannot confirm or deny that that is Matt.
And I think we should continue with that narrative.
Because a lot of people think that it's just me, you, and Matt in here. I don't know if that's the case.
There might be more people. Maybe. And I think, you know it's good to keep the audience guessing.
Absolutely. You never know what it takes. By the way, I want to quickly do a shout out to This Day in Crime History on Amazon Echo devices. You can enable the skill by searching for Oxygen, and you can hear what crazy crime story happened each day in history. Some of them are silly, some of them are disturbing, some of them are just freaky, but they're all very interesting nonetheless. And Darren, I don't know if you knew this, but I am the voice of This Day in Crime History on the Amazon Echo.
That is pretty amazing. Are you sure it's not Matt's voice and you're just taking the credit?
It could really truly be anybody. You don't know who's... What if my name's been Matt this whole time and no one really knows?
I mean, it wouldn't be the first time I've been catfished.
Do you think we're... Well, that's true. Do you think that we'll ever reveal Matt's true identity on the show? I feel like there must be some reason.
I think lucky listeners might get a chance. Well, remember, you know what I mean? They send in the right thing. They do. We'll do like a special reveal, a viewing party, if you will.
Well, remember, Matt, some people met Matt at CrimeCon and didn't even know it was him.
And before they meet him, I really want to get him a lot of plastic surgery because if he's going to be the quote unquote face of this podcast, we need a better face.
That's a good.
Because I gotta say,
it's easy to beat up on him when he's not here, right?
You know what? It's actually easier when he's here because I like making him cry. Like, that motivates me.
Totally.
Now that he's not here, it's like empty airwaves, and I don't...
It's a good point.
You know what I mean?
Well, let's move on to this week's murder.
Yes, please.
It's actually a famous case.
You probably have heard of it out there.
Yeah, you've probably heard of this. If you're listening to this and you've read the title, you probably already know. The Disappearance of Natalie Holloway is a show coming up on Oxygen, premiering August 19th. We've had a chance to chat with, we're going to speak with her dad. So by the time a future episode comes out, you'll be able to hear that.
Yes.
Dave Holloway.
Who's nice enough to talk to us. I can only imagine how hard it is for him.
You know, he has a new lead that may help him and his family, you know, come to some sort of closure with the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. So, basically, we wanted to focus on Natalie Holloway for this week's episode. I also spoke to one of Natalie Holloway's friends who was actually on the trip with her in Aruba when she went missing.
Wow.
Which, by complete circumstance, is a friend of somebody who works here at Oxygen. What are the odds of that? It was a fascinating interview. We are in the midst of cutting that as of this recording. So that'll be a video on Oxygen.com, but we're going to use a lot of stuff that we didn't use in the video on the podcast as well, including some clips today.
Is she still shook from it? Does she think about it still all the time, or has she sort of let the past be the past at this point?
You know, it's a little bit of both. That's a great way to sort of frame
closure for herself, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, how much can you be hung up on something like that, you know, when you're not a family? Yeah, exactly. But, you know, at the same time, she was one of the last people to see Natalie alive. Yeah. So, and she talks about it. It's really, truly fascinating. That stuff will be on a future episode of Martinis and Murder with clips on this episode, what we have available.
Absolutely.
So, Darren, let's jump right in.
I mean,
let's get to know Natalie Holloway.
Let me give you guys a little background on her first.
Do you remember when this happened,
by the way? Oh, I remember vividly when this happened because I've been to Aruba before. Mm. I actually think this happened around a similar time that I was there. I mean, granted, I was with my family, and I don't even...
Yeah.
I've never been the type... Not that it necessarily has to do with it, but I've never been the type to, like, go off on my own and go drinking and doing this. Like, I just... Yeah. It was a cruise. I was on with my family, you know, I was with my 85-year-old grandfather. So it wasn't, I don't remember my parents being like, no, don't go too far.
Sure,
you know, it could have been. But this story definitely shook me because she wasn't too far from our age.
She was my age. I was the same age. Yeah.
At the time, this is sort of a classic story of a classic field trip sort of gone awry, and there's just a number of theories. You and I love a conspiracy theory.
We're gonna get into some of the theories later on.
But let me give you a little bit of the background. Yeah. So Natalie Holloway, N-A-T-A-L-E-E, Holloway, was the oldest of two children. She was born in 1986, John's birth year.
That's true.
To parents David, who we'll be talking to in a future episode, and Beth Holloway in Clinton, Mississippi. She was a Southern belle, as you would say. Her parents divorced, however, when she was about 7 years old. And Beth remarried to a man who went by Jug, J-U-G, in 2000, and the family moved to Alabama. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Juggalo case that we had discussed a few weeks ago. I just want to put an asterisk on that.
No connection.
So Beth remarried to a man named Jug. Natalie was a star student at the local high school and a member of National Honor Society, Bible study, dance squad. She clearly is a well-rounded high school student. She worked part-time and also volunteered. Overachiever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was a counselor in a peer group called the Natural Helper. She was very close with her parents, and her father would regularly visit, or she would visit him and his new wife back in Mississippi. So even though there was divorce going on, the family still seemed pretty close.
Right. So just to, because we hear a lot about the headlines about how she was in Alabama. So her mom was in Alabama, but her dad stayed in Mississippi. So that's why you're going to hear a lot of those states mentioned.
Yeah, she moved when Beth remarried Jug to Alabama. Right, but he stayed. So she was a brilliant straight-A student, like I said, and she was actually accepted to the University of Alabama, roll tide, on a full scholarship to study pre-med. Which
I mean,
is
that's pretty significant.
That's insanely impressive.
Yeah, there you go. Good
full scholarship? I mean, that's wild.
Yeah.
Her father called her a sensitive, loving, and articulate young woman. And in his book, Aruba, The Tragic Untold Story of Natalie Holloway and Corruption in Paradise, a little bit of a long title.
That's fit.
Yeah. Natalie's uncle says that she was a bit naive and hadn't dated or partied much. You know, she seemed like...
She's 18.
Not only is she 18, but she's a good fucking student who seems to be so well-rounded and helping and volunteering. She probably doesn't have time to be a partier and doing the things that maybe other... delinquent high school students got themselves into, right, John?
Yeah, well, no, not me. Uh-huh. I will say this, you know, last week we were giving out parenting advice. Some fans really like that. So, you know, we're not making any judgments or giving any advice here. We're just simply saying, you know, she was on the right track. She was a straight A student.
Absolutely.
All good things going on, at least. To that point. So on Thursday, May 26, 2005, Natalie and 124 more students from her graduating class went on a five-day trip to Aruba. She was 18 years old. For those who aren't familiar with Aruba, you know, Darren, you've been there. Yep. Matt's actually been there twice.
Obviously.
Where hasn't he been?
He's like, I was there May 26, 2005. That's so weird.
I know, right? Exactly. Anyway, Aruba is a small Dutch island in the Caribbean. In case those of you aren't familiar, not far from Venezuela. So if you think Caribbean, like I always think of like what, Puerto Rico or something.
Sure.
Aruba's
Cancun.
Aruba's actually closer to South America than like those main island chains. If you look on a map, obviously anybody listening to this can probably just pull up Google Maps or something and look at it yourself. But it's very small. It's known for its white sand beaches and having basically perfect sunny weather all year round. In a very weird circumstance, I have like a handful of like best friends that are like my family. My one best friend and her wife just went to Aruba. And then my other best friend and his new wife are going there on a honeymoon in a few weeks. So
interesting.
Lots of Aruba connections here.
What I remember of it, and it was obviously a long time ago, was... Mm-hmm. You know, there it wasn't like there was so much to do there. It was literally just beach town.
Yeah, that's
all
what I
you
heard.
Saw was beach. That's it. I mean, it's a relaxing place, not necessarily you're going to like an adventure.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
seven chaperones accompanied the teens. Appearing on Fox News in 2006 for an interview, Bob Plummer, who was both a chaperone on the trip and a teacher at the high school, said, "Quote: We met with the students every day to make sure that everything was fine. That you know, nothing was happening. That everything was going okay with." Them, end quote, which is an interesting note. I think we have to just really take note here that the chaperones were around, you know, like,
yeah, I mean, if there's seven chaperones for 124 students, that's what?
Oh, how dare you ask me to do math on the spot.
Well, I was going to say that's probably like 18 or 19 people. A person, I can do the math right now.
Go ahead. I'll keep going while you do the math.
Which feels like there's like a, you know, a classroom.
Sure.
That does make sense if you think about it. Yeah. 124 divided by 7.
That sounds
17.7 students. I was pretty good with my mental math. Yeah.
But as you might expect, the chaperones didn't have like 24/7 knowledge of the whereabouts or actions of the graduates. According to Fox News articles published in June 2005, the woman who organized the trip said, quote, the chaperones were not supposed to keep up with their every move. Another note I wanted to mention was Natalie was 18 at the time, and so were probably many others that were on this trip. So technically, I'm not sure, you know, it wasn't like chaperones with fifth graders, you know.
No, of course, where they can't even, you know, speak for themselves.
They were all adults.
And technically, by Aruba standards, I'm pretty sure you can drink at 18. So these students were probably, like, so excited to legally have that.
That time,
exactly.
I hear you. You know, many of the teenagers behaved as one would expect, drinking and partying. Gerald Dompig, which is a tough one to say here on the show.
I almost thought there was a misspelling on the sheet because I was like, Gerald Dompig?
Or maybe it's Harold because, you know, the G could be silent. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who was the deputy police chief in Aruba at the time Natalie disappeared, speaking to Vanity Fair for a 2006 article said, quote, this group of students was a very, I don't want to demonize them, but the group really went far, very far, in terms of having a good time. Wild partying, a lot of drinking, lots of room switching every night. We know the Holiday Inn told them they weren't welcome next year. Okay. Natalie, we know, she drank all day, every day. We have statements. She started every morning with cocktails. So much drinking that Natalie didn't show up for breakfast two mornings, end quote.
Seems odd.
It's a weird statement, but we should mention this right now, that the police in Aruba have come under scrutiny over the years for the way they've handled Natalie's case. We're going to get into this later, but there are people, including Natalie's family, who wouldn't put much stock into what the police say, frankly.
Totally. And even that direct quote, you know, saying, Natalie, we know she drank all day, every day. It's like, if the chaperones weren't there, how do you know?
And also,
how are you making such a definitive statement?
And this is only my opinion.
Why does it matter?
This is, yeah, exactly. This is only my opinion. But in my experience, I don't know many straight A students who are pre-med who would then go to a beach and drink all day. I'm just saying, like, that doesn't fit a character type to me, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
but
not,
I don't know.
Yeah, that's not fitting the piece that I'm thinking.
In my head, at least. I'm not saying it's general, you know,
right,
as a blanket statement. But anyway, when asked by Fox News in a 2006 interview whether Natalie was drinking on the night that she disappeared, Bob Plummer said, quote, the whole time we were down there, I never recall really seeing her drink a whole lot, period.
I mean, so if she's drinking all day, every day, and then the chaperone on the trip says, I don't really recall it,
that seems to not
work out. No. It doesn't seem to be the same statement.
And
you
this
know?
Doesn't match up with what other students, including her friend Jessica, who we spoke with, had to say about the trip. Everyone was having a fun time. Jessica even showed us pictures of Natalie at the bar that they were all attending the night she disappeared. You know, there's been a lot of talk about how much the students were partying.
Right.
In a missing murder case, does it matter how much she was partying? Isn't this just victim blaming? We've heard all this before on the show that we've done, you know. It's like,
well, Kristen Smart.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Kristen Smart's one. I feel like there are a few others. It's like, why does it matter what they're doing? If somebody is missing, then begin the initial steps to find them.
I agree with you in terms of the amount, although I do think it's important to kind of know the toxicity level, only to at least maybe gauge what they would have done if they were stone cold sober. You know, were they at the bar? Were they doing this? Are they more likely to not be able to give consent to something? So maybe they weren't driving. I think to some extent it matters. With here, I feel like it's just starting to paint a negative picture of her and not one that's going to help solve the case at all.
Yeah, well, and as mentioned, on the night of Sunday, May 29th, which was the last night of the trip, Natalie and her classmates went to a local bar and nightclub for their last hurrah. This was called Carlos and Charlie's Bar. For those of you who may have heard this.
I think it's a chain in the Caribbean.
Could be. It sounds like it is.
Yeah, I feel like I've been to one in Mexico. Oh, Cancun,
really?
Maybe. I don't. Yeah.
According to the poster distributed by the FBI seeking information on Natalie's disappearance, which is still available on the FBI website.
For sure.
This is how the night unfolded. Natalie left the club at 1:30 a.m. on the 30th of May with 17-year-old Joren Vandersloot, which we'll get into him, I'm sure.
What a name, too.
If you've heard Natalie Holloway, you've heard that name.
Yeah.
And two other men who are brothers, Deepak Kalpo, who was 21, and Satish Kalpo. Calpo, who was 18. According to the poster, Natalie never made it back to her hotel room that night, and the following morning, when she was supposed to meet the rest of her class in the hotel lobby to be transported to the airport for their flight home, Natalie never turned up. Now, this is very much in line with what Natalie's friend Jessica said about the trip thus far.
Okay.
Let's listen to what she had to say. Again, this is just a clip from Jessica. She was one of the last Alabama students to see her that night.
This is like the most traumatic part for me for sure, because we thought it was a joke. We were all on the bus. We had to be on the bus, I think, at like 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock in the morning to leave. We had been out probably till 1 or 2, nothing crazy, but we were all on the bus and we were, you know, taking roll, and the one person missing was Natalie. So we're joking, we're laughing, we're like, oh my God, where is she? She must be passed out somewhere. She must be asleep and not hearing her alarm. How funny. And then very quickly, it turned into, oh my God, where is she? Like, how come we can't find her? That was definitely the hardest. And it quickly turned to hysterics and searching our phones and every single person texting her or trying to get in touch with her. Many people saying, we are not leaving. It was hysterical. The bus was hysterical. Only people that stayed, I think, were 2 or 3 chaperones.
That's good to know that all the facts are sort of lining up with someone who was there. Mm-hmm. But I think what's so, not that this would have been better, but this was the last night of the trip.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's really so eerie about it. That,
I thought that too.
They go out for their last night from this, you know, week away or whatever, and this happens. It's just...
And it's like the last night of the trip, she made it through this trip.
Right.
You know, there's a killer.
Everyone's leaving now. Yeah. You know,
I mean... I hear you. Well, let's talk about, you know, the disappearance exactly.
Right. So we left off there. So Natalie's mother, Beth, was alerted to the fact that her daughter didn't come to the hotel and didn't make her flight back to Alabama, which kind of juxtaposes what Beth said about her later, which said, I knew immediately that my daughter had been kidnapped in Aruba. Natalie has never been late in her life, which fits with the narrative that we were saying before, you know, straight A student, honor roll, all that stuff. So Beth and Natalie's stepfather, along with 2 of his close friends, flew to the island immediately after hearing the news.
As any parent, I'm sure, would.
I would think so. Natalie's father, Dave Holloway, was alerted shortly after and got on the soonest flight he could book. Natalie had been missing for 3 days at this point when Dave went to the police department and said he wanted to talk about his missing daughter. According to Dave's book, published in April 2006, the first thing the officer said was, quote, how much money do you have? End quote. Though Dave also stated in interviews with MSNBC in 2005 and Fox News in 2006, whether the officer was making the comment in jest or whether he may have been referring to reward money of finding Natalie. So still, that's kind of an odd first question to me to ask, but I could see it being played both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Dave wrote that the officer then said Natalie probably met someone and had fallen in love. Quote, this happens all the time, the officer allegedly said. She will probably just show up in a few days. I wonder how often that does really happen, though, that people just get whisked away and doing it. And is that enough of an excuse? Like,
that's what
it happens. So kids run away from school all the time. So don't be worried. Ha ha. They'll turn up in 3 weeks. What?
Well, it's like, this is so disturbing. I would want to see examples of this quote unquote happening all the time. I mean, like I said, regardless.
Yeah, give us numbers here.
Yeah. And regardless, shouldn't they be working on those initial steps to potentially find her? Darren just threw her.
I mean, I threw my cap and now I'm stuck.
Do you want me to get it for you?
Could you?
Okay.
And bend over slowly. That's what I like to see, John.
Here you go.
Thank you, sir.
Got it.
Sorry about that. But that's all right. I mean, but regardless, whether or not it happens all the time, whether or not it's like a rape allegation.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
People have sex all the time. Rape is happening. Okay. But you have to take it seriously no matter what it is. Even if it winds up not being true, even if you find Natalie in love with somebody, you have to take it seriously. I figure that's a.
Especially in a beach town where these types of things are
happening all the time.
Yeah, happening all the time.
So meanwhile, Beth and crew had been doing some digging on their own by talking to Natalie's friends and the nighttime manager of the Holiday Inn where the school group had stayed. They learned that Natalie and some friends had gone into a casino during the day she disappeared, and that's where Natalie actually met Joran.
And this is exactly in line with what Jessica had said, who was actually at a casino and saw Joran Vandersloot.
Yeah.
Let's hear what Jessica had to say about this, because I thought this was crazy. What a crazy moment.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So I remember seeing Joran van der Sloot at the casino at our hotel. That was the first time I saw him, and I remember chatter of him. Like, he's so cute, who's going to hook up with him? Those types of things were floating around. That was probably the extent to which I got close to him. I definitely remember seeing him. I was playing blackjack. That's the only game I know how to play, but I don't know what he was playing, but he was there. And I don't even remember if Natalie was with him at that point or if any of us were necessarily with him.
So, yeah, she was there. She remembers seeing him. I think that's just insane, you know?
Considering now that when you Google him or he was plastered right. all over the news, it's like she sort of saw him in the light of just being an 18-year-old, 17-year-old kid at the time. And now I look at him and I'm like, ooh, I don't know. Like, there's so much mystery surrounding it. Of course, by now they'd been told the story about how she was last seen in the car with Joran and the two brothers. CNN reported on June 2nd, 2005, which was just 3 days after she went missing. Quote, her mom says that her daughter was last seen leaving a local nightclub around 1:30 a.m. Monday morning with three locals and has not been seen since. And 3 days, I mean, that's quite a while.
Chunk of time to just not be around, yeah.
I mean, it didn't take Beth long to actually get an address for Joran, and they went to his house to ask him some more questions. At first, he obviously denied knowing Natalie at all, according to Vanity Fair, which goes against what Jessica was saying. Before they left, the police showed up, and they also began to question Joran. Dateline on NBC noted that Joran's father was hovering over the situation. His name was Paulus van der Sloot. Paulus?
Paulus, probably, yeah.
Paulus van der Sloot, and he was politically connected. He was a politically connected legal official in Aruba.
Right.
He dropped dead, though, in 2010 while playing tennis.
Yeah. So there's my connection to the case. I'm a tennis player.
And you were alive in 2010.
Right. That's a good point.
As far as we know, allegedly you were alive in 2010. Alive.
I can't confirm or deny those facts just yet on this particular show.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
So now let's talk about Police Superintendent Jan van der Straaten. When the police started putting pressure on Joran, he said he did know Natalie and that he'd met her at the Holiday Inn Casino on Sunday afternoon, and she asked him to go to the bar with her later that night. According to Vanity Fair, later that night, he changed his mind. Quote, so I snuck out of my house and went over to see her. She came on to me huge, dancing suggestively like a slut. I did belly shots on her on the bar. Eventually, she said, could you take me home? So we left. You know, I think
interesting.
I think it's interesting, you know, when you're being questioned about someone's disappearance, who uses the word like slut to talk about a girl who may have just been murdered?
Right.
Like, I think that shows, in my opinion, just as I sit here today, in my head, I feel like to me that shows a disregard to her. It's a it's disrespect to her, to her family. Like, why would somebody who is sympathetic say that? You know what I mean?
you know, I don't even have an explanation for it. Because even, whether or not you want to be saying that you didn't know her at first and now you do know her, it's like if you're trying to not be suspicious, you're not doing a very good job.
Joran said that the last moment he and the Calpo brothers saw Natalie was when they dropped her off at the Holiday Inn and watched her go into a hotel or into her hotel at around 2 a.m. According to a CNN article published June 9th, 2005, he said that as he drove away, he saw a, quote, dark colored man wearing a t-shirt and carrying a radio helping Natalie, who was stumbling. According to CNN reports from the time, investigators examined security footage from the Holiday Inn, there was no sign of Natalie at the time Joran said he dropped her off.
Interesting. Also not very smart to think that they wouldn't have security cameras in a hotel.
Right, of course. Well, as you have all heard, I'm sure if you followed this, back in 2005, an epic search began with American volunteers and Arubans joining in. Aruban banks raised $20,000 towards the search effort, and jets flew over the coast taking offshore photos looking for clues. Again,
it's not that big, by the way.
I was just going to say, this isn't some giant... This isn't the... Australia, some giant island. Right. It's a kind of small beach town. I would imagine it's probably not much bigger than what, New York City? Maybe it's bigger than that. I don't know.
I mean, considering the fact that there isn't much, you know, like you'd think hiding in New York City would be a lot easier than hiding in Aruba because you thousands of places you can go. Right. Aruba's not really like that. And so I'm assuming this is great that they raised $20,000 into full search,
On June 6th, Natalie still hadn't been found despite widespread searches on the tiny island and the U.S. government working closely with the Aruban authorities. Natalie's disappearance had become national news in the United States by this point, and then Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice told reporters, quote, "It's obviously a case about which we're very concerned and we're all watching and working and also praying that this will come out all right," end quote.
I think I remember that exact moment when Condoleezza Rice was saying
it. Oh, really? I don't remember it.
Yeah. It just, all very interesting politically, especially the press that this got. We'll get into that later,
definitely.
But it's interesting. So let's remember, Natalie went missing May 30th, 2005, mm-hmm. and on June 5th, Aruban police arrested two former security guards at a nearby hotel who fit Joran's account of the man he saw with Natalie after he dropped her off. Remember that dark-colored gentleman, he said, on suspicion of murder and kidnapping, according to an NBC News article. But neither was officially charged, and they were both ultimately cleared and released after 8 days in custody.
And, you know, remember, at this point, when you hear the word Joran, he's still just the last person that may have seen her. You know, he doesn't have any, you know, there's nothing pointing to him at this point. However...
Well, great segue, on June 9th, Joran and the Calpo brothers were arrested on suspicion of murder and kidnapping, according to NBC News. Under Aruban law, quote, "serious suspicion is grounds for holding a suspect, but at the time, the Aruban Attorney General refused to say on what grounds they were being held." Now, remember, Joran's dad was very politically connected, so we don't know how all of this sort of relates yet.
Okay.
Police told CBS News that they had considered the trio as prime suspects and had been surveilling them with telephone wiretaps and email monitoring. Mm-hmm. So this was a high-end operation. They were all released without being charged with anything. But the brothers were ordered released without being charged with a crime. Their release came less than a month after being taken into custody when a judge determined that there was not sufficient evidence to continue holding them. Joran was also released after being held for 3 months without ever being charged with a crime. Also, he was held for 3 months. That's kind of a long time considering he wasn't charged with anything.
Yeah.
Speaking to CBS News, police confirmed throughout that time that they did not elicit a confession or find a body or any other physical evidence. And to be honest with you, we've talked about this before, you got to release someone if there's no evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just like your hunch.
Right.
So throughout this time, attorneys for Joran and the Calpo brothers repeatedly denied any involvement by their clients in her disappearance. And on June 17th, 2005, so now we're talking a little over 2 weeks after her full disappearance, police actually made another arrest. Steve Gregory Crows, a friend of Joran's who worked as a party boat DJ, interesting job, mm-hmm. as a party boat DJ, according to Fox News article, published the following day. Joran's father was also arrested, but he and Crows were released on June 26th and were not charged with anything. So again, no evidence linking mm-hmm. them to the crime. Meanwhile, while all of this is going down, Joran just couldn't get his story straight. He changed his version of events at least once, according to Fox News article from August 2nd, 2005, telling police he was on the beach with Natalie alone and that he left her there by herself unharmed.
So, okay, it went from the last he saw her, she was walking into her hotel room with a, quote, dark-colored man. Now, what? The last time he saw her was on the beach. So when you're fabricating one of these huge stories, doesn't that, you know, point to a big red flag?
And remember, the first thing he said was that he never even met her.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So now we're going from never even met her to I dropped her off on the beach alone, unscathed.
Oh, God.
Okay.
I hadn't even thought of that. Joran said the cowpost had dropped them at the beach and that he had left because Natalie was so drunk, she was drifting in and out of consciousness.
Oof.
Consciousness. Natalie had been front and center on cable news since she'd gone missing, as I'm sure all of us remember who were watching the news at that time. In early 2006, Joran began to speak to the press, inciting even more of a media circus. In an interview with ABC News in February 2006, he said he had intended to have sex with Natalie that night. Quote, I asked her if she wanted to have sex, and she was fine with it. I didn't have a condom with me, though, in my wallet, and I won't have sex with a girl without a condom, end quote.
Gentlemen.
Yeah, what a gentleman.
A gentleman.
Right? Again, but this again is like, you don't, why are you saying this?
And people say chivalry is dead, John. I don't get it.
And aren't you, by the way, Joran, at this point, aren't you curious what may have happened to her? Like, talk about that. You know, help the investigators if you were one of the, truly one of the last people that saw her.
You know, maybe his father being involved or something gives him, maybe he thinks he knows better or smarter because he grew up around this. We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know what he was like.
He also said in that interview that he made a mistake leaving her alone on the beach that night. Quote, we cuddled a while on the beach just laying there until I said about time to walk her back to her hotel. At that moment, she said she didn't want to go back to her hotel and she wanted me to stay with her because it was her last night. I tried to convince her to go back to the hotel and she said, just put me down. I should have brought her back to her hotel, or I should have made sure I left her with someone, one of her friends, but I just should have gotten her back to where she should have been, end quote. I have a hard time believing anybody with a brain would just walk away from someone who's drunk and drifting out of consciousness on a beach. Right? Like, doesn't that seem
especially
odd?
A woman.
Yeah.
When there's no, you know, foul play or anything going on. She's just drunk. Just, like, put her in a car and take her to a hotel.
Right. You don't just leave someone sitting on a beach.
That seems weird that he would shift from, I dropped her off at her hotel, to now, like, oh, well, yeah, I should have probably stayed with her, but now I just left her.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, like, getting worse and worse.
He told ABC News he initially lied about knowing Natalie because he didn't want anyone to know he'd just left her alone and drunk on the beach in the middle of the night. Yeah, I probably wouldn't want that to be the case either.
Yeah, that's not a good thing.
In April 2007, 20 Dutch investigators arrived to carry on the investigation in Aruba. A reporter for CNN at the time said, quote, they say they have some crucial piece of information that justifies this search, but they won't say what the piece of information is, so they're sort of perpetuating the mystery. What we do know is that they are literally digging. They're tearing up the Vandersloot yard with metal rods, shovels, jackhammers, and they're bringing in dogs. So the question is, does that indicate that they feel that there's evidence in there, even possibly a body? We don't know. We're going to have to wait and see, end quote. I also want to take a second here and just mention that I know we're citing a lot of stories here, but it's really important to report accurately about how this stuff
Absolutely.
Was being reported. I know that a lot of you guys maybe listening don't like to hear all the according to's, but...
Or a quote.
Yeah, but it's really important. I think it's only going
to... Especially with this case.
Yeah, and it's only going to add to the accuracy of how we report about this, not just now, but, you know, historically in the future, should someone look into our little podcast.
Absolutely.
A spokeswoman for the prosecutor's office said at the time, quote, the team has indications that justify a more thorough search, according to CBS News, though she declined to provide more detail on why. Joran's father felt the search was an invasion of privacy, saying, you can hardly believe it, but they must have seriously been looking for Natalie in our garden. It's incomprehensible. In that sense, I am angry, and I hope this will be the end of it, end quote. Yeah, I mean, if you're innocent, and here comes, you know, a backhoe to dig up your lawn,
right,
that's going to be frustrating. No new evidence.
Yeah, and that's emotionally disturbing for you as well.
Right, that they would even be thinking of it, right? Apparently. Well,
yeah.
No new evidence was found at the Vandersloot home. In May 2007, police also investigated the Calpo home, and according to NBC News, the brother, quote, objected to the action and had to be escorted from the property by police officers. It sounds like he wasn't really into that idea the same way I was just saying you know, people don't want backhoes in their backyard.
Yeah.
Again.
Speak for yourself, John.
Again, no new evidence was found. But then on November 21st, 2007, police rearrested Joran and the Calpo brothers, quote, on suspicion of involvement in voluntary manslaughter and causing serious bodily harm that resulted in the death of Holloway. This is according to Fox News, quoting a statement from the Aruban prosecutor's office, with the office also stating that they had, quote, ordered their renewed arrest because further investigation into the disappearance has led to new incriminating evidence, end quote. So Joran's mother speaking, so here he is getting rearrested. They have new evidence, allegedly. Joran's mother, speaking to Fox News the following day, contradicted this, insisting he wasn't arrested or put into handcuffs, but rather taken into custody for more questioning, and also said, quote, I think it's ridiculous after 2.5 years to be doing this, end quote. Meanwhile,
I mean, by the way, just as an aside, sorry to interrupt, but like, it would be ridiculous 2.5 years later if you're innocent and you've said the same story a million times, but you haven't said the same story a million times.
Well, meanwhile, Natalie's father says, quote, I hope I'm not going to be disappointed. We've seen these arrests and rearrests in the past. That's hard to say, by the way. By the end of November, the Calpo brothers were once again released when, according to CNN, a judge, quote, concluded the evidence against the Calpos was not strong enough to warrant their continued detention, end quote. Deepak's attorney said Deepak, quote, is trying to get his life back to normal in hopes that finally this case will stop haunting him. Fair enough.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, again, innocent at this point. The prosecution appealed the release, but a judge denied the appeal and said, quote, notwithstanding expensive and lengthy investigations on her disappearance and on people who could be involved, the file against the suspect does not contain direct indications that Natalie passed away due to a violent crime, end quote.
I mean, that gives at least some sort of closure.
Reasoning,
I mean, you're not going to get like, it was this person on this day at this time doing this, but at least we have something.
Yeah. Shortly after, in December, Joran was also released because, according to a statement by the Aruban prosecutor's office, issued that a judge determined that, quote, recent investigation has not resulted in more direct evidence than before that Natalie Holloway has died as a result of a violent crime against her or that the suspect has been involved in such a crime, end quote. So, at the end of the day, at this point, they're saying, we had evidence, we looked into it, then we looked at it again. There's not enough here to keep people and arrest them. There's no body.
We've had search parties for this. Thousands of dollars have been spent.
I mean, they don't have a thread of her clothing to go by, you know?
And that's what's so difficult with a missing person's case is just, you know, I bring it back to Kristen Smart where it's so frustrating and it's like different than a murder because you never get that closure for this, you know? So what happened to Natalie then? You know, now it's been years and there have been so many theories that are being surmised about this. In fact, you and I have to be very careful when we talk about all these things because we don't lead it any other way. I mean, we're still not sure. And so we just kind of want to discuss every theory that's out there right now and give our two cents on what's going down. So the first theory is actually the fish trap theory.
Now, this theory is so disturbing and I had never even thought about it. And I was like, oh my God.
When I read this the first time, I was just like, I didn't even hear it, actually, the first time. You know, I mean, I think the presumption was like, oh, well, you know, someone got off and blah, 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 and it just happened.
Right.
But this is very interesting. So the fish trap theory. The Holloways eventually hired a Texas man named Tim Miller, whose own daughter had been killed in 1984. He started an organization called EquiSearch to help other families find lost loved ones, which seems like a super noble cause.
Yeah.
Tim spent nearly a year in Aruba investigating the case. He'd been searching in landfills with Dave Holloway when a deputy police chief told him, quote, I think you all need to be out in the sea 3 to 5 miles, end quote. Miller later learned that there had been a break-in at a fisherman's hut on the beach the night Natalie disappeared. A metal and wire box fish trap had been stolen. And Miller learned that 90% of the bodies of people who drown on the side of the island where Natalie went missing float up to the banks of Venezuela. As you were saying, it's very close to South America. The currents, I'm sure, just flow up there. So Miller said, I don't think that they was willing to take a risk on Natalie's body floating. He theorized that they, whoever they are, might have stuffed her body in a trap to weigh it down to the ocean floor. So Miller teamed up with someone who had an underwater exploration business in 2007, and a research vessel was deployed to scan the bottom of the ocean to look for traps that might contain Natalie's body. It's just like, I know where this is going, and it's like so disheartening. So Miller had ideas about where Natalie's remains might be based on the water currents like we were talking about. On Christmas Eve in 2007, sonar pictures showed a large trap right around where Tim had actually guessed. This seems very positive.
Yeah.
They dropped a remote-operated vehicle into the water to photograph what was inside. And Miller says he saw what he believed looked like a human skull. He said, quote, "In my years of searching, we have seen several bodies, skeletal remains. I've seen my own daughter's skeletal remains. I can't help but believe at this moment that this is that is human remains in that crab trap," unquote. I mean, this is coming from a father who lost his daughter.
I mean, the idea that you would see your children's skeletal remains is like one of the most disturbing things I've ever
Anybody's remains, let alone your own flesh and blood.
Right.
He actually even called Dave Holloway to say that we found her. But the next day, a Reuben police divers and divers from Tim's crew discovered there were actually no human remains in the trap.
And I don't know. I'm not trying to judge anybody. I'm sure this
broken
was,
heart.
Yeah. But I mean, in my opinion, I don't know. This guy's credibility just changes if he's assuming that he's seeing a skull and then immediately calls the parents and says, "We found her." I mean, you have no idea what that is. How could you do that? You know, especially on Christmas Eve, no less. At the very least, okay, if it is a skull, take the skull out. DNA forensics
something.
With it. You have to do something before you call the parents and say,
I was going to say, you should have been conclusive because then they have to relive it all over again with even more positivity. Now, you know, having that closure and then you take it away, it just feels so shitty, honestly.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Well, another theory is that Natalie was sold to sex slavery.
This I actually have heard of before.
I have heard of it too. And you know what's funny is, well, not funny, but interesting is that back at this, in this time, you know, this is 2005, obviously, I wasn't as aware of, and I don't think the public was aware of sex slavery in general.
Yeah, this it sort of feels a more contemporary issue
exactly.
to me.
Exactly, and it's one of those things that's starting to get a little bit more light shined onto it, and even myself as just a casual, you know, news observer have noticed that how important of an issue this is, especially with other documentaries coming out.
Oh, 100%.
About it. You know, I'm sure there are some that you can find online and elsewhere. So This was an interesting theory, and we'll read that now. So in a bizarre interview with Fox News on November 24th, 2008, Joran said he sold Natalie into sex slavery and that his father had paid off two police officers who knew the truth. Though by the time the interview ran, Joran had already recanted these statements with Fox News, confirming that Joran contacted them and, quote, "told us he had been lying during that interview and that he had not sold Natalie Holloway to a stranger." Joran says he made that story up. But, end quote. But he provided Fox with a recorded phone call.
This is interesting.
That he said was between himself and his father, which Fox News aired the day after the interview and confirmation that he had since recanted. After the interview and confirmation that he had since recanted, here's that conversation. So I'll play Joran.
Okay, I will be his father.
Okay. So here's how that went. "Hi, Dad. How are you?"
"I'm all right, you?"
"I'm sort of fed up. I can't stand it any longer."
"Joran, hang in there a bit longer. You must keep tough."
"I just want it to be over. I don't care what will happen to me."
"I understand, but too much has happened. You have to be strong."
"I do my best, but I really don't know. I feel rotten."
"Joran, you have no choice."
"Yes, I can come forward and end this."
"Yeah, not a good idea, I think. You have to think about us, too."
"Yes, I will do that, but if they find the girl, there is at least proof I didn't hurt anybody."
"But what you have done is pretty bad. Human trafficking is a serious crime."
"I know, but how could I know where all this would lead to?"
"Joran, it's a shame you made certain choices, but there has to be a moment it will stop, okay? You cannot talk with anyone about this. Do you understand?"
Okay, so that's the conversation that they had.
Which he's since recanted.
Right, but so it hasn't been verified if it's actually his father on the recording.
Right.
And his father denied ever having that conversation, but why would Joran make all of this up, and why would he
implicate his father?
His dad there. Yeah, that just really did not make any sense to me.
We're seeing the thread kind of unfold here. I think this is sort of the start of those
theories. That's a good point.
Theories.
According to Joran's attorney, who appeared on Fox News the day after Joran's interview aired, he made it up to sell it to the news media. So what? You're basically confessing so that you can sell a story to the media? That doesn't make any sense. Fox said they did not pay him for the recording, but gave him a licensing fee. We don't know how much that fee was.
Man.
But an attorney for Natalie Holloway's parents told Fox News, quote, "You know, the most logical explanation of how Natalie could disappear, absolutely vanish into air within a half hour of being dropped off at the beach with Joran in with Joran is consistent with what he said. And all the other evidence points towards it too, that she was led down to the fisherman's hut. She was led to the shore, you know, alive, well, and led onto a small sports utility vehicle. And, you know, very willingly got on board. And before she knew what was happening and Joran didn't get on board, you know, the boat took off and she was subdued eventually," end quote.
I mean, it all could happen very fast. So in theory, from what we know, I mean, that does kind of line up.
Yeah. And well, here's what's really crazy. Joran was reportedly being investigated for recruiting women to go into a sex trafficking ring. To be fair, this story was broken by the National Enquirer, who claimed he was, quote, posing as a production consultant for a modeling agency using the alias Murphy Jenkins. And according to a Dutch journalist, Peter de Vries, who spoke with the Enquirer, he, quote, promised they'd make big money and live a luxurious life, end quote. I was just going to say, I mean, we don't want to get too in the weeds into this theory.
Right.
Who knows if it's even true, but I always felt like there was some kind of financial interest here with whomever did whatever to her. I don't know why. I mean, I think it's a mixture
it's
of
like
all the
hunch.
News, but
yeah.
It's like, especially with how he's, like, his behavior, and we'll get into, like, what happened later with some extortion things. It just always kind of seemed like a money motivator to me.
I mean, even him claiming to almost, like, indict his father and then,
right.
Like, why well, I wanted to
for
sell
money.
It to him. Everything just seemed, it doesn't seem to add up to anything other than that.
Further investigation by CBS News in July 2010 led to confirmation from government officials that, quote, Thailand was pursuing criminal charges against Vandersloot, unquote, though he was never ultimately charged.
Well, Joran says he knows where the body is. So according to NBC News in the spring of 2010, Joran contacted an attorney working for Natalie's mom, Beth. Okay. He said he knew where Natalie's body was located and that he would bring the attorney to her remains for an initial payment of $25,000 and total payment of $250,000, and also provide specific details concerning the manner of her death. No wonder you have money on the brain, John,
right.
Because all
That's
of this is sort
point.
Of being brought back to this. The attorney secretly contacted the FBI, but he did go to Aruba to meet Joran. He gave Joran $10,000 in cash and wired another $15,000. Like, wow.
Yeah.
But again, if this can put all of this to bed, it's it's a drop in the bucket.
And also, like, how dumb are you to try to, like, put money like this up to her,
attorneys? Yeah.
Are you insane?
And think that the attorney wouldn't know how to handle it.
Right, exactly. That was my point.
Joran took him to a location, but odd, there were no remains found.
Yeah.
So luckily, the FBI was actually also there, and they secretly recorded the attorney giving Joran the money. According to a joint statement released by the FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office on June 9th, 2010, the U.S. attorney filed a criminal complaint charging Vandersloot with extortion and wire fraud on June 3rd, 2010. All right, so they're getting him on something.
Something, yeah.
A federal grand jury in Alabama indicted Joran on one count of wire fraud and one count of extortion for this incident on June 30th, 2010, according to a subsequent statement made by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Following the indictment, a spokeswoman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Birmingham, Alabama, told People magazine that they plan to, quote, pursue extradition, end quote, of Vandersloot, even though at the time he was in custody in Peru after being accused of another crime, which we'll get to in a second, John.
Yes.
But he has yet to face the charges in the federal indictment. And as the U.S. attorneys pointed out when announcing the indictment, the defendant is presumed innocent. So Joran later emailed someone that he'd given the Holloways worthless information, according to NBC News. In fact, Joran later admitted that he'd extorted the family. A Dutch newspaper quoted him as saying, I wanted to get back at Natalie's family. Her parents have been making my life tough for 5 years. Now, before we get to his other crime that he committed, which I know you're about to get into, to be fair, that last statement that I just made about, I mean, granted, I'm not condoning what he did or saying that, like, oh, right. he should have extorted them. But if he was innocent, all the shit that he's probably going through has to be rough.
Yeah.
You know, I'm obviously he's not making it easy on himself.
No,
but
I was just going to say.
All things considered, I understand if like someone was innocent and he got so frustrated. I mean, there's no excuse for doing what he did. But that actually that statement does seem like the most truthful thing he probably said.
Yeah. Well, Stephanie Flores was a third year business student at the University of Lima in Peru. She was 21 years old and lived with her father, Ricardo Flores. Ricardo is a well-known former race car driver and is politically connected. His nickname is The Rifle, and he's known for an aggressive style of driving.
I would not want to fuck with that guy.
Don't, you know, no road rage with this guy.
Yeah.
Stephanie had four brothers, and one of them told CNN, quote, "My sister was the only girl in the house or in our house, the queen of our family." Her brother said she was, quote, "very friendly, always smiling, and always nice to everyone," end quote. She was a big soccer and poker fan. And on May 30th, 2010, Stephanie played in a Texas Hold'em tournament in Lima, but never came home in the morning.
What was that date you just said, yeah, John?
This happened on May 30th, 5 years to the day that Natalie Holloway disappeared. Yeah. Ricardo began calling all of her friends, but no one knew her whereabouts. The police checked out surveillance video at the hotel where she'd been playing poker, and guess who was sitting right next to her?
Ooh, pick me. Is it Joren van der Sloot?
It is. Oh. It was Joren van der Sloot, though at the time they didn't even know who he was. After some digging, the police found out his name, and they shared it with Ricardo, who said, quote, "My wife typed Joren van der Sloot into Google and started screaming for me to see. I couldn't believe it. How could it be that guy? All I've been doing is reading about Natalie Holloway and what her family has gone through."
I mean,
quote.
It's 5 years. I mean, I still remember, and now we obviously, because of this thing we have on oxygen, I've been seeing the posters around the office, but
yeah.
I remember her face is ingrained in my mind.
Mine too, yeah. I just remember her eyes were like such a standout, even
Absolutely.
Before we started working on stuff. Joren stole Stephanie's Jeep Cherokee and fled the scene. On his way out of the hotel alone and carrying a backpack, he told hotel staff not to bother his girl.
Ooh, creepy.
A manhunt began, and Joren successfully evaded the police for 4 days. He had ditched the Jeep and crossed over into Chile, but he was spotted by Chilean police in a taxi heading south toward the capital, Santiago. Later, Stephanie Flores' body had been discovered in Joren's hotel room 3 days after the murder. It was an exceptionally bloody scene. After Joren was extradited, he confessed to the murder after initially telling police an armed intruder broke into his hotel room. He said the two had been playing online poker on his computer when an instant message popped up from an unknown person threatening his life for being connected to the Natalie Holloway disappearance. He then claimed Stephanie freaked out and attacked him, striking him on the left side of his head, saying, quote, "She was on the bed when I hit her hard with my right elbow, and I think her head went back and hit the wall. Then she begins to bleed. Immediately, I get on top of her with both hands. I begin to strangle her, keeping her that way for a minute. After that, I throw her to the floor, but she keeps breathing. At that moment, I take off my shirt and put it on her face, pressing on it. I don't remember for how long, but she stops breathing. In this way, I think I caused her death." End quote.
Yeah, I think in that way, you're probably going to cause that. We don't know much.
That might be how you do it.
We'll have to ask Matt because I've never killed anyone.
That's true.
It seems like it would kill somebody.
Well, as for motive, he simply said he, quote, "lost control. She hit me in the head. I lost control of my actions. I didn't know what I was doing. I remember what I was doing, but not the motive. It was an impulsive act after receiving a blow to the head," end quote. So he's basically trying to say that, you know, the message pops up.
She
gets enraged, this woman, and starts to hit him. And, like, this was in some ways an act of self-defense. Like, that's not going to fly.
Isn't he, like, a bigger guy?
That's
what
I thought.
Not big,
yeah.
Like fat, but like tall.
No, yeah, I think. The violent emotion plea is typically used in Peru for crimes of passion where a spouse, for example, is surprised in the act of adultery. It's similar to a charge of manslaughter in the U.S. So basically, if you're surprised that your, you know, husband or wife is cheating on you and you just react in whatever way you can, that's called the violent emotion plea, which is different than a typical, I guess, manslaughter
so
charge.
So that was his plea. plea that he entered after he was accused of first-degree murder and faced a 15 to 35-year sentence?
I believe so, yes. Okay. So Stephanie's father said, quote, there was violence, resistance to being raped, and there's where she was murdered, end quote. The crime scene photos are very brutal. There was a lot of blood. His elbow to her nose must have been very hard. And she had bruises all over her body, including on her feet.
Now, that was an interesting thing for me to think, because I would never normally, you know, you think about the neck, you think about the face, sure, you think about the body, but feet?
Yeah, feet is a weird one. You're
feet
right.
Feet seems like a struggle to me.
In January of 2012, Joran was sentenced to 28 years for killing Stephanie. Coincidentally, around the same time Joran was sentenced, a judge in Alabama declared Natalie Holloway to be legally dead. So again, another kind of weird coincidence with an
I want to look up
date.
Like what it takes to consider someone legally dead.
Too.
We should have looked that up, like how long do you keep the search for if you've never found anything?
Or... Yeah, I'm curious about that myself.
So basically, you know, fast forward to today, where's Joran now? As we mentioned previously, Joran is still presumed innocent with respect to the wire fraud and extortion charges in his federal indictment and will remain so in the eyes of the law unless proven guilty at trial. According to a CNN article from March 2014, Peru has agreed to extradite Joran van der Sloot to the United States, but only after he finishes serving a 28-year murder sentence, the Peruvian news agency Andina reported. So the earliest he could face trial for those charges would be 2038 in the United States, if ever.
Yeah.
So he has some time to wait. In 2014, Joran got married in jail. He met his wife while she was visiting a relative in the prison. Prison life in Peru allows for visits within the confines of a jail cell.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Because then...
Well, ergo, the two had a baby in September of 2014. And in November of the same year, his wife said he'd been stabbed in prison and seriously injured. The wounds were reportedly 2 inches deep, with one coming close to his kidney. 2 inches deep?
That's a lot.
I mean, that's with force.
Yeah.
The prison chief said the stabs were self-inflicted, and Joran was just trying to generate sympathy for himself. I mean, I don't know whether I want that to be true or not, because, like, that's sad either way.
Yeah.
In 2015, he wrote a letter to his wife saying that he feared for his life in prison. Quote, the inmates of Chalapalca believe if they kill me, the maximum security prison will be shut down, he wrote. I beg authorities to take action on my case before it's too late and blood is spilled, with all due respect.
Mm.
Earlier this year, while in prison in Peru, Joran was once again caught on camera confessing to killing Natalie. Caught on camera.
Yeah.
But many believe the confession is yet another lie.
Yeah.
With Natalie's mother's attorney saying, he's looking directly into the camera when he speaks, and I would venture a guess that it's either a cellmate or a guard who's filming for Joran and selling it and splitting the proceeds with him. This is how he operates. There's no way he's confessing out of the blue to some random person with his wife sitting there. This was for a quick buck. It was all planned and absolutely meaningless.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of thought that too. I was like, it's clear that he's motivated by money. So, you know,
I mean,
when you're
him
prison,
just sitting there,
desperate. Yeah.
Yeah, with like a blank stare. I mean, that right. would be what I'm thinking, especially because his wife is there. And
yeah.
he's serving a sentence, which still would give him a life afterwards. So it's not like he's serving 8 year terms, 8 life terms, and then
you
might as
no
well
hope.
Just confess to it. So this does seem like a play and a reminder, the disappearance of Natalie Holloway, which is an amazing show on Oxygen, premieres Saturday, August 19th on Oxygen. What her dad finds, I promise you, will blow you away, and you have to watch it.
Yeah, and we're going to, like we said, we'll be speaking to him very soon. We'll have a separate podcast episode with him. We're going to be putting up our interview with Jessica, who was on the trip with Natalie on Oxygen.com. So check out Oxygen.com. There's all kinds of stuff with the Natalie Holloway case that we're going to be posting and revealing and, you know.
And tweet us your thoughts on this, and like, do you think that any of these theories are true? Do you believe Joran wasn't involved at all? Do you believe that he was? Do you think evidence is conclusive? And watch that special and let us know what you guys think too.
Yeah, we're at Jay Thrasher and at Carpe Darren. You can also tweet at Oxygen Crime or use hashtag Oxygen Crime. Lots of ways to sort of communicate, and we might end up reading them on the show, kind of like right now, Darren.
Yes, now we've come to listener shout outs.
So Kaysen on Twitter says, quote, rough is when, I said quote, I'm so used to quoting.
I know.
Kaysen on Twitter says, rough is when you want to joke about hashtag Dan, your wife is here, but literally no one gets it. Hashtag martinis and murder.
Well, Kaysen, we get it.
We get it. And should we do a quick Dan, your wife is here?
Yeah.
Dan, your wife is here.
Dan, your wife is here.
Dan, your wife is here.
That never gets old for me.
No, it won't.
Free M06 on Twitter says, enjoying all three of you on the show. I'd like to think that was like us and then the alcohol.
I have a reaction. Okay. I have a reaction.
Enjoying all three of you on the show. Keep the murder and mayhem coming. Thank you, Free M06. But when you say three of us,
it better not be Matt, because the last I checked,
could be the lawyer. Could be Allison.
It could be Allison.
And
the
she's
lawyer.
Great.
Yeah, Allison and the lawyer has sort of become... Yeah, Allison's amazing.
Yeah, amazing.
No.
It's not
the,
Matt.
She's the antithesis, if you will, to Matt. You know what I mean?
She's the classy of all of us.
And also,
she's the classy
feel
one.
Like she would also do a really good martini? I don't know why I think that.
Yeah. It's obvious.
Matt's maybe made one or two good ones over the last 31 episodes.
Matt's the one who gave us Yingling one time. So I'm pretty sure Allison's not going to screw this one up.
Apparently everyone loves Yingling, by the way. I don't know if you've heard this.
And a lot of people like Yingling.
Like, after we posted the episode, a lot of my friends were like, oh my God, what did you love your Yingling? And I was like, I took two sips and threw
it
away.
Shitty cheap beer to me here. Whatever.
Anyway, maybe Matt will be here for another episode in the future, but that's it for this week's episode of Martinis.
Maybe
and
he's
Murder.
In Aruba right now trying to solve this case for us.
He literally is on vacation, so he could be on a beach in Aruba. Who knows?
I mean, it's funny because what I want to say, if I've learned anything, well, if I was ever convicted of a crime, I think the number one thing I would do is keep my story straight.
That's
because
a good
the
point.
Second you go back in a story, regardless of if you're guilty or innocent, you're going to be questioned so many more times than need to be.
Yeah.
Be honest.
There you go. Life advice from Darren for everyone
out
there.
Yes, parenting advice next week.
All right, that's it for this episode. Stay tuned for more Natalie Holloway-related things, and we'll be back with new episodes.
Have a good week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.